Hey team, welcome to the Student Paramedic Podcast Pediatric Miniseries with Dr. Andy Tagg. Hey team, welcome back to the Student Paramedic Podcast. This is our second episode of the Pediatric Mini Series with Dr. Andy Tagg. Today we are following on from our first episode, which was about the Pediatric Assessment Triangle and some important considerations when assessing children. In today's episode, we are going to be discussing the ABCs of the wheezing child. Just a disclaimer for this episode, please follow your jurisdictional ambulance or local pathways and guidelines. This information that's presented today in terms of any management is for information purposes only. So, Dr. Andy, thank you so much for coming on for a second episode today. Do you want to give us an insight into what it is about the ABCs of the wheezing child?
I would say that almost 50% of the children I see in a pediatric emergency department have some sort of breathing problem. And they've often got one of three main conditions, which I'm going to call the ABCs today. That's asthma, bronchiolitis, and croup. And I think if you get a handle on those three common conditions, you'll feel so much more comfortable when you go out on a job and you're seeing your kid at home. And I hope you'll get an idea of how to manage them, how to assess them and how to manage them. And also get a sense of, you know, which kids can be left at home and which ones can be potentially taken into, need to come to the emergency department. But as we talked about in our episode on the pediatric assessment triangle, kids are not just little adults. And there are some obvious anatomical differences. And if you think of any children, you see, imagine this. If you look at a child, imagine Dobby from Harry Potter. They've got giant heads. Often they've got floppy tongues. Often not much tone, very little muscle mass. And children often have very small airways, which gives them that higher pitched voice. As kids get older, their trachea and their larynx gets bigger and they're less likely to obstruct. But when children have any sort of airway obstruction, whether that's from an intrinsic thing, so a foreign body in the middle of the airway, like a peanut, or swelling of the walls of the larynx or the trachea, like in they've got laryngotracheal bronchitis, or, you know, croup as we would call it. Those things narrow down the airways, make it difficult for air to get into kids, and they'll often make a noise when they're breathing. And as those airways narrow down, it's like you're trying to breathe through a straw when really you want to snorkel. It's really tricky for kids, and so they'll use as much of their energy and their time as possible concentrating on breathing. They'll do that nasal flaring, like Rowan Atkinson as Mr. Bean. They'll have that tracheal tug, that intercostal and subcostal recession. They'll do that belly breathing. And they'll have an increased respiratory rate as they're trying to suck air in. Added to this is the challenge that often younger kids, you know, under 6 months of age, are what we call obligate nasal breathers. They have to breathe through their nose. They haven't got a coordinated enough system so they can breathe through their mouth like you or I can. And so as soon as their nose gets blocked off by snot, then they find it really, really tricky to breathe. And so those upper respiratory tract infections, which children are so prone to getting, causes a lot of problems. And as they start getting blocked off noses, they have difficulty breathing. And then if the child has to focus on either breathing or feeding, they're going to concentrate on the breathing rather than anything else. So I said there were three main problems to deal with. That's like asthma, bronchiolitis, and croup. And there is often a continuum between asthma and bronchiolitis and preschool wheeze, and the language changes around about every 6 months or so. But if you think of asthma as a problem where there's hyperreactive airways, increased mucus production in the lungs, those are the two main causes of problems. And you'll get those kids that are often get their first presentation of asthma, just like you imagine, you know, those kids are getting short of breath running around in the summer season when there's a lot of rapeseed oil seeds around. They have got that sort of hyperreactive airways and problems with hay fever and eczema, and they may have that sort of reactiveness, and they'll get a wheeze. And often that starts off as just a bit of a mild respiratory effort, not a huge amount. If they've got very mild asthma, they may have a bit of a cough, and often that cough is more prevalent at nighttime, and that may be the first sign that they've got asthma rather than anything else. They get an increased respiratory rate, and then you might hear a mild wheeze if you listen to their chest. And that wheeze is kind of like a musical note, both in and out as they're breathing out. And again, imagine you're blowing over the top of a beer bottle. It's that musical note, and that's what's really making that sound, because the airways have been narrowed and restricted. Children, when they become worse, when the asthma gets worse, they often then struggle to do anything. They may have increased respiratory rate, and they're sitting in a position of comfort, which makes it easier for them to breathe. And that's often just sitting still rather than running around the place. And the sign that they're getting moderate, moving on from that mild to moderate asthma, may well be that they're just doing less. Their respiratory rate has gone up, as we talked about in our pediatric assessment triangle episode, and they can have an audible wheeze and an increased cough. They're talking less because, they're focusing more on their breathing. And then as their asthma gets worse, all they can do is focus on breathing. So sucking air in is what we call air hunger. They're often just staring into the distance, not coughing as much, and that's much less of an issue. But they're really tripoding, leaning forward to try and open up their lungs as much as possible to get the air in. And those are the really sick asthmatic children, the ones that are going to need urgent attention and emergent care. Occasionally, you'll hear a wheeze when you listen to those kids' chests, but more concerning is when you don't hear anything. They've got what we'll call a silent chest, because it's really difficult for them to get the air in and out through their really inflamed airways. So that's your asthma. Really, really common. Much more common in the summer months because of seeds. And we certainly have a problem over here in Australia with thunderstorm asthma. And you may have noticed it yourself, that you actually get more shouts for asthma when there have been thunderstorms in the air. And so it's certainly something to be aware of. If you look at the weather forecast and it's been a hot, humid day, you hear the thunder cracking overhead and you think, oh great, it's going to be some rain, it's going to make life a lot easier. But actually, that humidity can drive asthma attacks. And we've had some really big major incidents over here in Melbourne when we've had a thunderstorm asthma, when we've been just zooming around the streets, throwing salbutamol at anyone that barely looks wheezy. What do you need to do with these kids? Well, I think the first thing to do is encourage them to use their own treatment if they've got it. It's great if a child's got an asthma action plan, and all children should have one. But if they don't, the next thing we're going to do is going to start some treatment. And that's really about keeping calm, giving them some salbutamol, so Ventolin, that's the blue inhaler. And we're going to use that through a spacer device. When I first started training, we used to use nebulizers for pretty much everyone. And we know that spacers are way more effective in getting small droplets of salbutamol, beta 2 agonists, into these kids. Much less scary, much less noisy, and much better for them. And best of all, it's the same treatment that we're going to send these children home on. So if we start them on that treatment pre-hospital, they get used to what's going to be going on in hospital and going home. It gives them and their parents a sense of autonomy and control. And if they're only having a mild asthma attack and they just haven't used their spacer, sometimes all we need to do is remind them of the appropriate technique. So shaking up that inhaler to first, attaching it to the spacer device, and getting to take some slow, measured breaths. And often that will settle things down. We'll often give them a burst of salbutamol. So that's, an age rate dosed number of puffs. So if they're under 6 years old, we'll often give them 6 puffs of salbutamol over sort of 20 minutes. And we'll do that 3 times over the course of an hour. And often that's enough to abort most minor asthma attacks. If things get worse, then we might add a second agent. We might use Atrovent or ipratropium bromide, depending on what your CPGs, your local guidelines say. And then we're going to consider further treatment if they get more and more unwell. But most simple attacks can be aborted with some salbutamol and a spacer device, and occasionally removing from the source of the problem. So, kids sitting in the middle of having just done sports at school and they've got exercise-induced asthma, sitting in a newly mowed lawn, I would just get them out of that environment and get them inside before you start treating them. And that's it for the basics of simple asthma. As the child becomes more unwell, we might need to do more things. And really, often the problem with asthma is not so much an oxygenation issue, it's just a getting tired issue. So that child with a normal oxygen, you'd expect most children with asthma to have normal oxygen saturations. Even the sick ones often have normal oxygen concentrations. The problem is often, you know, getting air out rather than getting air in sometimes. And so they'll start developing gas trapping. They find it really difficult to breathe. You rock up often to a school and you see a kid with clearly having a severe asthma attack. What are you going to do in that situation? I think the first thing to do, like any situation, is to remain calm yourself, because we know that calm, that sense of calm, is contagious. You know your job. You know what you're going to do. You know as soon as you walk across the room to see this child, you can pretty much get a sense of what's going on. You know, imagine that 7-year-old is having an asthma attack. They've got that wide-eyed look because they're freaking out. They're getting really panicky and stressed. And by you remaining calm and walking to them, that's going to help alleviate the situation. You're going to get a history from a teacher or a carer that's with them. Get a sense of what's going on and find out what treatment has been given already. And whatever treatment has been given, you're going to start with some salbutamol via space. So you're going to get down on their level, let them know what you're there, and say, hey, let's just try and slow your breathing down. We can give you some medication, some medicine that's going to make your breathing a lot easier. Show them the inhaler and get them started. Once they've had that first round of salbutamol, then you can start attaching any monitoring equipment you want, getting them prepped and ready to move out. But you really want to start that treatment as quickly as possible.
That's fantastic. That's a lot of information that you've been able to unpack there. And I really appreciate how sort of simple you've made that seem, which is really handy when trying to get a good overview of asthma, particularly in children. So what age group, Andy, are we looking at with patients who do have asthma? What age are they getting diagnosed from?
So it's changing. So this year, as far as I'm aware, we've changed it now. So it used to be that you couldn't be diagnosed with asthma until you went to school. And now we have a condition called preschool wheeze or viral-induced wheeze. And now the nomenclature is changing again. So that may be now being called preschool asthma. And really, I would suggest that anyone over the age of 2 can be diagnosed with asthma. And the main thing that delineate suggests it's asthma, it's a reversible airway hyperreactivity, as opposed to something like bronchiolitis, which is an infective process that causes disease. And while some viruses can make asthma happen, and we all know things like adenoviruses and rhinoviruses, and even coronavirus can cause viral-induced wheeze, it's an airways hyperreactivity that is characterized by lots of mucus and a reversibility. So that's one of the reasons why we treat with beta-2 agonists and steroids. If you think about those other wheezy kids, we see the younger age group, that sort of, let's say, the 1 to 2-year-olds, often they might have something that's much more akin to bronchiolitis, that infective process. And when you listen to their chest, they sound very different. The bronchiolitis is one of the commonest causes of, you know, under 2-year-olds going to hospital. It's about 2% of all hospital admissions in children because of bronchiolitis. And it's caused by, you know, essentially by the RSV virus, which thankfully now we've got an immunization program in the UK for, and hopefully we'll introduce it over here soon enough. But kids with RSV, again, they produce a lot of mucus. They have that airways hyperreactivity. But the mainstay, what they often they'll have is, when you listen to their chest, they're crackly rather than wheezy. And so kids will start off with a snotty nose, a runny nose for a couple of days, maybe a little bit of a cough at nighttime. And then they'll start getting the symptoms, sort of the main breathing related symptoms around sort of day 2. And day 3 is often their worst. And so unlike an asthma attack, which can come on all of a sudden, you know, the child may be completely well that morning and asthma suddenly comes on that afternoon because there's been exposure to a potential allergen or trigger. Most children with bronchiolitis have already been unwell, a bit snotty, maybe had a bit of a temperature for a couple of days. They may be off their food. And often then what will happen is as they start to produce more and more snot, their nose gets bunged up, they become unable to breathe. And so they start mouth breathing. they may have head bobbing, and then that's part of their, because they're really using their abdominal muscles to breathe rather than anything else. They'll have that nasal flaring, that tracheal tug, and they'll just be sitting there looking miserable. Kids with bronchiolitis often then fall into two camps. You get happy kids with bronchiolitis, and you get unhappy kids. Happy kids are often sitting there with a respiratory rate of 40, sat in the sort of 95%, and just chugging away, looking around as if there's no problem, and their parents are just really, really exhausted. Or you get the sick kid that is not feeding. And really, when we're looking at kids with bronchiolitis, we're concerned about their oxygenation status, their respiratory rate, and their ability to feed. So from an oxygenation status, and it depends on where you are, often we'll use a cutoff between 93 and 90, sats of 93 to 95%. And really, that is often a random number rather than anything else. And we don't know what happens in the long term. We know certainly from a lot of studies that if I saw a child and they had sats of 95% now, then I could send them home and they could go to sleep and their sats could drop to 80%. And I would never know about it because there's no adverse events. But certainly as a kid who's got persistently low oxygen sats below 93%, I'm much more likely to admit them to hospital because they're on that sort of tricky slope of their oxygen dissociation curve when things can get very worse very quickly. And so a kid with sats of 93%, or certainly kids of 90%, I may want to be giving them a little bit of supplemental oxygen. And really that's getting mum or dad or a carer just to hold an oxygen mask near them, because you're never going to get a one-year-old to have a face mask on. When I'm assessed, so that's assessing their oxygenation status. If I'm looking at their respiratory rate, I'm really looking at how fast they're breathing, their effort of breathing, and their efficacy, or how effective their breathing is. And if they look like they're working really hard and they're getting knackered, exhausted, then I'm going to want to do something about that. And often that's going to be bringing them to hospital and maybe to consider something like high flow oxygen. And then I'm thinking about, well, great, they're working really hard at breathing, they're full of snot, and they're not taking the breast, or they're not taking the bottle, or not feeding. And again, that's often an indication that child needs to be admitted to hospital. And we'll try often just simple oral hydration. But if that doesn't work, we'll often put a nasogastric tube and put that in. Because once that kid's stomach is full of snot and mucus, they're going to feel full. They're not going to want to breathe as effectively. So we'll suggest that parents give a small volume feed, slightly less than normal. They don't have a full tummy. It makes it easier for the kid to breathe. And so that's going to be one of, again, that hydration status and how well they're drinking is a good marker of badness. And one of the challenges with bronchiolitis is that there is no treatment. It's time, more than anything else. And in the past, we've tried everything from hypertonic saline, NEBS, to salbutamol, to steroids, to antibiotics, to Heliox. And there's been no real treatment that's been effective. And so it's really hard to go up to a kid and say, actually, you just got to ride it out and wait. And so for us, it's a lot of what we do in hospital is education as to, from a safety netting point of view, when do these children need to come into hospital? And as I said, it's when the oxygen levels drop. From your point of view, obviously parents won't know that. When there's an increased respiratory rate and when the feeding changes, so amount going into them drops off and the amount coming out of them, so the number of wet nappies drops off.
That makes a lot of sense. And in regards to sort of bronchiolitis, what are the particular sort of age group that you'll see that in most commonly?
So essentially it's that one year to 3 years old. So the typical child you see is an 18-month to two-year-old child who's fully immunized, is normally well. And the classic history is they've had a two-day history of an upper respiratory tract infection with a snotty nose, maybe a low-grade temperature, and they've called an ambulance because they've got increased work. They've had a cough last night and then increased work of breathing, and they're not feeding as much or not eating as much as normal. And you go and assess that child, and if it's mild to moderate bronchiolitis, you may see a bit of tracheal tug, a bit of intercostal recession. Sats maybe around 95% respiratory rate, up a little bit. And you listen to their chest, and you can hear crackles. And it's kind of like, if you imagine, like you when you try and get those bags at the supermarkets, put your fresh produce in, you can't open it, and you're rubbing them together to try and open it. It's kind of that sort of noise you can hear in their chest. Whereas the sicker kids, often it's, again, it's really obvious. And they're thinking from a pediatric assessment triangle point of view, you know, they're not crying at you. The tone is often normal, but they're they're not really paying attention very much to the world around them because they're just sitting there concentrating on breathing. Their head's bobbing away. They've got that increased respiratory rate. They've got those all those sort of extrinsic signs that they're working hard to breathe, and they're not really doing very much. They're often not really paying attention. And the children that worry me most are those that are kind of lying there floppy in their mum's arms. They don't even have the strength or the energy to hold themselves up. They'll barely open their eyes when someone comes and prods and pokes them and puts a SATS probe on. They're not interested, that they don't engage, they're not scared of you. That worries me a little bit more. And so it's really important then to make sure when you go and see these kids, you have a proper look at them, because, you know, this is a virus that's often much more common in the wintertime, and these kids are rugged up against the cold. And so you want to make sure you're undoing those layers, undoing those onesies, lifting up the vest, and actually having a look at the chest rather than trying to guess through the clothes.
Absolutely. And I guess that obviously also gives you a bit more information in terms of their colour and that circulation side of it as well, and if they've got rashes and things like that as well. In terms of bronchiolitis, just one more question for you in regards to that. You mentioned sort of that 1 to 3 year range. Is it, in your eyes, is it common under sort of that 12-month range as well?
I certainly have seen it in younger kids, and a lot of it depends on who's at home with them, what else is going on. And realistically, you can get them from anything from 6 months onwards, because like I said, it's a viral infection. And if you're in an area where you're exposed to lots of other children, when you go to childcare, you're much more likely to get it. I think the thing to think about is, you know, that onset of the history. It's often a slow onset history. It's accompanied with that fever and the snottiness. And there's a sort of a spectrum between upper respiratory tract infections and bronchiolitis. And a lot of the viral infections are cause similar sort of symptoms. And it's often not easy to tell when you first see them. And it may be that you're called out to see a kid on day one because they've got a bit of a temperature and a bit snotty, and you don't know what's going to happen to them. And so if we see them on day three, then it's blindingly obvious, because on day one, they may have a clear chest, and on day three, they've got like those classic crackles of bronchiolitis. So, you know, children's illness is often a continuum, and you only see them at one point in time. It can be hard to tell. And so often I'm just cautious and I'm lucky in the emergency department. Often I've got that luxury that I've had a bit of time for things to develop. But if I'm seeing a kid that looks really well, he's had a one-off temper and he's got a mild respiratory rate, and then, you know, they're 7 months old, it certainly, well, could be bronchiolitis, but I may not know that day. And so again, it's good safety netting advice, making sure they follow up with their GP or their primary care provider, or come back to us if there are any issues.
Thanks for clarifying that. That makes quite a bit of sense now. So we've done A and B. What's next?
Is C, for croup. And again, really, really common condition in young kids. Croup is laryngotracheobronchitis. And essentially, it's a viral infection of the larger upper airways. It's characterized by that sort of barking seal-like cough that keeps parents awake at nighttime. And for some reason, you only ever seem to, at least in my practice, you only ever seem to see it at nighttime. And the big concern for us is that it causes upper airway obstruction. Not as common now, but it used to be a reasonably common reason that kids would get intubated, because they do have narrower, smaller airways when they're young. And any amount of swelling can massive in those, the walls of those airways can, you know, reduce the diameter of the trachea that they can breathe through. And so these children with croup often present with essentially a cough, often a dry sounding upper airway cough rather than a snotty mucousy cough that you might get with bronchiolitis. And that cough is, you know, persistent, may lead to some post-tussive, post-coughing vomiting in kids, but not as common, and tends to be present at nighttime. It may be accompanied by other signs of upper airway obstruction. And then we're looking at things like what's happening in this sort of that sort of suprasternal notch. I get concerned when kids come in with croup. They're not really moving a huge amount because they're scared. They feel they can't get much air in, and you're seeing a huge amount of tracheal tone. That's a big, big red flag for me. But for most children with croup, they'll settle down nicely. They'll cough and cough and cough, and it's really annoying. And often that cough may be positional. So they'll lie down on their pillow at nighttime. There may be some dust or animal dander on their pillow. That's just going to set them off even more. They'll start coughing and hacking away further. And that causes their parents to call and bring them to the ambulance, or bring them to the emergency department. And the main treatment for croup is steroids and different districts will have their personal choice and dose of steroids. We tend to use either prednisolone or dexamethasone. And we don't really know how steroids work in croup. It makes sense in my head that it should work as a sort of an anti-inflammatory agent and do something. But the way steroids work, it's going to take 8 to 10 hours to do anything. And that's not what really happens. We'll see a child with croup in the emergency department and they will appear to get better within the hour. And that's just like magic. It's like an amazing medicine. And we're giving oral steroids. And what we really want to do is start looking in kids' mouths, prodding, poking them, scaring them, because that's just going to freak them out and maybe make their airway obstruction worse. And we're going to give them a dose of oral steroids, and that's weight-based, and keep an eye on them and see what happens. And the vast majority of children will get better. If they're not getting better, then we're going to escalate our treatment. And the next stage of our treatment, in our guidelines, certainly, and in most ambulance service guidelines, is nebulized adrenaline. And that, again, is going to work locally to try and reduce that inflammation in the airways and make things better for them. And we may go on to give a second dose of nebulized adrenaline. If after they've had a dose of steroids and two doses of nebulizer, then I'm really worried that something's going to happen and they might need further intervention or other treatment. And certainly I've transferred patients to the pediatric intensive care unit for closer monitoring in those situations. One of the challenges with croup is often making that diagnosis, that first time croup. It may sound, you know, if they've had this croup every winter, it's great, easy, straightforward, sounds like croup. What sounds like a seal is a seal, that sort of thing. But it could be that it isn't croup. And that's where you need to think about what is the differential diagnosis. What else could it be? That child that is completely well 1 minute and then starts wheezing the next, I'm thinking, what else is this going to be? And the two things I worry about are inhaled foreign bodies. So bits of Lego, seeds, button batteries, lolly wrappers, sweetie wrappers, those sort of things, or anaphylaxis, if there's been a recent exposure. And so if you think that one of those two things might be the diagnosis, act on it. If you're giving treatment for croup and things are not getting better, consider, are you actually making the right diagnosis? Yes, you've been out to see this kid, and it sounds like they've got croup because they've got this audible, you know, stridulous noise. They're making it every time they breathe. You've tried them with some oral steroids, your prednisolone, your prednix, and it's not made any difference. You've given them some nebulized adrenaline, and that's not made any difference. Have you got the right diagnosis? And this is a situation in hospital, certainly where we may be thinking about doing chest x-rays on these children, looking for something else that's going on, looking for that inhaled foreign body.
That's really interesting. And obviously in the UK, or at least in the service I work for, we don't do nebulized adrenaline. So that's going to be a bit more challenging to sort of see that acute change in the patient. Because if you give them the dexamethasone or whatever steroid you may have in your service, that, like you said, is going to take a bit of time, and we're generally not with this patient for, you know, an hour, depending on sort of the location and things like that. So that can present quite a challenge. So that's quite interesting just to have those as the differentials and guess using that for your history taking. In terms of that sort of risk stratification for those patients, do you recommend using things like sort of the Wesley croup score and things like that, or just more so your clinical assessment of the patient?
So I would tend towards using your clinical gestalt, your assessment of the patient. The Wesley croup score was really designed for research purposes rather than in practice use. And so I would be much more inclined to say, you're looking at this kid, they've got marked tracheal tug, they're making a noise, they've had steroids, it's not getting better. That's all you need to know. They need to move somewhere else. And you want to do that in as calm a way as possible, you know, avoiding interventions, avoiding looking in the throat. In the olden days, before we had immunizations, we used to worry about things like epiglottitis causing these airway obstructions. And so we would, again, avoid putting things in these kids' mouths. You know, we're having resurgence of whooping cough over here in Australia at the moment. Again, a cause of those sort of those airway noises. But realistically, all those children should be transported to hospital for further assessment. I think the kids with mild croup, often they'll just have that annoying cough it'll keep the parents up, maybe a mild tracheal tug, and that's fine. And as long as they have access to healthcare, they can get to hospital themselves, they live nearby, you know, they're sensible parents who understand some discharge instructions, great, you can leave them. But otherwise, it's, you know, they're the ones who need to come to hospital. And as I said, some kids need time. And over the winter over here, you may go into the waiting room and you see 7 or 8 kids waiting to be seen with croup. They'll arrive, their parents have brought them in at 2 in the morning because they're coughing and sputtering and keeping the parents up all night. And by the time they're seen, 4 or 5 hours later, they're completely back to normal. We may well have given them a dose of steroids, that triage. And by the time they get to see us, they come in, they're back to baseline. And often kids may need 1 or 2 doses of steroids, and that croup illness often lasts just for 2 or 3 days. It's not a prolonged illness. Whereas, you know, asthma is not going to get better in the same sort of time. It may, certainly if mild asthma, may get better in the same time course, but without beta-2 agonists, without salbutamol, it's not going to make much of a difference. And bronchiolitis, steroids will make no difference in that sort of setting.
Absolutely. Well, I feel like we've had a fantastic deep dive into the ABCs of wheezing children. Is there anything you think we've missed or any sort of important considerations you want to include as well?
So I think, you know, the climate of respiratory diseases has changed a lot over the last 4 or 5 years. And so it's really important to make sure that as a paramedic going into any situation with a child with respiratory illness, you keep yourself safe and you're wearing your personal protective equipment and you put your face mask on. Because the number of times I'll go in and see a kid and the first thing they do with a coughing and they've got a respiratory illness is start coughing and spluttering all over me. And so make sure you've got your PPE on, your face coverage on. Because although croup in an adult is a mild illness, it still takes you out of action and will make you feel lousy. And you've got to think that what is the virus causing that croup? Well, you know, there's lots of viruses, but nowadays you've got to think about, is it going to be COVID that's causing it? So look after yourself first.
That's fantastic. I feel like this episode has been incredibly informative. There's been a lot of fantastic considerations as well. Now, quick disclaimer for all of our listeners as well, make sure that you are following the protocols and local guidelines of your area you're working, whether it be a jurisdictional ambulance service or hospital, whatever it may be. This is for information purposes only. Thanks for joining us on the second episode of our pediatric mini series. Please stay in touch with us. Let us know how you're finding it so far. And stay tuned for our third episode coming out in a week's time. Make sure you follow us on social media and reach out to us on any of those platforms, as well as email, to make sure that we're giving you the content that is right for you.